is NHPR News.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Almost a half century ago, back in 1964, the U.S. government came up with an official definition of what it means to be poor. The effort was part of President Lyndon Johnson's war on poverty, but four decades later, we're still debating what poverty really means in America. The original formula was pretty basic. If you had to spend more than one-third of annual income on food, you were considered poor. In today's dollars, that translates to an official poverty level of about $24,000 for a family of four. But this definition has long been criticized as outdated and too simple, and so late last year, the Census Bureau presented a new yardstick, dubbed the Supplemental Poverty Measure, and it includes a lot more variables. On the income side, benefits like food stamps, subsidized school lunches, tax credits, housing assistance are all counted, as are expenses like medical spending, taxes, childcare, commuting costs. Under this new definition, the percentage of poor Americans increases slightly from 15% to 16%, but the demographics of poverty show some surprising changes. Children appear better off economically under this new formula. On the other hand, the number of elderly poor rises. Today in The Exchange, measuring who's poor and who isn't in America and why these definitions matter. Let's hear from you, too. How do you define poverty? What factors do you think should be included and what should not? Also, how should these definitions be used in terms of public policy and research? Our number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or send us a short email, the address exchange@nhpr.org. Joining us from D.C. is Robert Rector, Senior Research Fellow at the Heritage Foundation. He's researched and widely written on poverty issues for more than 20 years. And Robert Rector, good to have you. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
And joining me in studio, Beth Mattingly, Director of Research on Vulnerable Families at UNH's Carsey Institute. She's also a Research Assistant Professor of Sociology. And Beth Mattingly, nice to have you in studio. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Well, and Beth, I'll start with you. So just remind us how these poverty definitions are used and why we should care about these.
Well, right now, the official poverty measure is used for eligibility for different safety net programs. So families below the poverty measure or at a certain percentage of the poverty measure, so maybe at 150% for some programs, are determined eligible to receive that. They're also important because for researchers, we use the official poverty measure to understand how a certain level of hardship influences people's lives. So, for example, research shows that growing up in poverty has lifelong consequences in educational attainment, in risky behaviors, in occupation and earnings, and for individuals' health.
So give us a list, if you could, Robert, just of all the programs that are based on the poverty level. Why, again, this matters?
Well, there are about 70 different programs that are provided to lower-income people. And those include the Earned Income Tax Credit, Medicaid, public housing, Section 8 housing, food stamps, school lunch, school breakfast, many, many. We're spending close to $1 trillion a year assisting poor people under these different programs.
Wow, that is a lot. 70-some-odd programs based on this one measurement. And yet, Robert, as you know, this definition is often criticized, outdated, and so forth, and we'll get to that. But why did they define it back that way in the 60s as, you know, one-third of your income is supposed to go to food, and if it's any more than that, you're poor?
The original definition was that what they do is calculate how much money it takes to buy a certain minimal amount of food, and then they basically multiplied that by three because the average family spent about a third of its income on food. But the crucial distinction back then, and we'll come back to this issue over and over again, was that what was the left wing within the bureaucracy at that time within HEW said, what we want is basically a measure that measures inequality. And so if your income falls below a certain percentage of the middle, then we're going to define you as poor. no matter how what your absolute standard of living is. And back then, the Johnson White House said, absolutely not. That's not what we're trying to measure. We're trying to measure actual physical deprivation here, and we're not going to go with an inequality measure and call it poverty. And that was the ruling, and what has really happened here, as we'll proceed through this discussion, is that the Obama administration has reversed that ruling. And we have now created a new poverty measure in which the goal line will shift invisibly every time you measure it. And one of the most striking things about this new measure is because the poverty thresholds in each community are now basically linked to the median income in those communities, if I were to wave a magic wand tomorrow and everyone in the entire country had their income doubled, under this new measure, there's no reduction in poverty at all, because the threshold by which you determine whether a person is poor would also double. It's very confusing, and I think it will generate additional misunderstanding.
So, Robert, just to clarify, are you saying that the new way of looking at it, and we'll definitely get to that, is more relational, how well you're doing versus others? The old definition, are you saying that was better because it was more solidly based on what you need to survive?
The old one, you basically were trying to measure how much meat and potatoes someone can buy. Under this new measure, what you're measuring is how much meat and potatoes someone can buy compared to other people. And they're not very clear about the fact that that's what they're doing, because I don't think there's a lot of support for that. But that's in fact what they're doing. They're basically sneaking in a measure of income equalization, spreading the wealth, and saying that they're still measuring poverty, when in fact they're now measuring something very different.
And Beth, let me get you into this too. What about the old definition then? It was really criticized as overly simple, and yet there's some critiques of the new definition, as we're hearing from Robert too. First of all, your thoughts on why the old definition was not workable. It wasn't ideal.
I think the biggest problem with the old definition is that when it was constructed, food represented approximately a third of a family's expenses. Today, that's no longer true, as things like childcare and transportation take up a much larger share of
medical
the family's
expenses.
Budget. Exactly.
So just defining it on food doesn't make sense, because food is a lot cheaper now than it used to be.
It's less of the budget. Other things are more expensive.
Well, and yet I understand, Beth, that the old definition is going to prevail when it comes to determining who's eligible for those federal and state programs that Robert mentioned, you know, from the earned income tax credit to Medicaid to school lunches and so forth. So we've got this new definition, but we're not really using it.
At least in the interim, the old definition will maintain its status as the official poverty measure. The supplemental poverty measure released by the Census Bureau is considered experimental. All that's been done with it so far is what was released in September in a primary report that they put out. And a number of scholars are looking at different ways of measuring poverty, and this is one of those ways that the Census Bureau is working with.
So this isn't the final say on this?
Not yet.
Not yet. And what do you think, and Robert, hold on, I just want to ask Beth also about Robert's point that he's taken issue with this new definition. He says, look, we should define poverty on, you know, what you have in your home, you know, the quality of your, you know, do you have food, do you have a shelter and so forth, and not define poverty related to, you know, how you're doing compared to the Joneses.
The new supplemental poverty measure does have a relative component. It's about approximately based on what the bottom third of Americans spends on a core bundle of things like housing, like food and so forth. Other advances, though, with the supplemental poverty measure are that it measures income differently. So, for example, as you mentioned earlier, some of the non-cash assistance programs that people receive get counted as income.
Like subsidized school lunches.
Like the food stamps and TANF. Well, TANF isn't in either, but like Medicaid. But also mandatory expenses, like work expenses for childcare, transportation, and so forth, are subtracted from income. And a big one is medical out-of-pocket. So we see changes in the demographics of the poverty population, but we also see that we can look at the effectiveness of some of the safety net programs because they are considered.
I want to give out our phone number and then, Robert, hear from you too. Our number on the exchange is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Today in the exchange, we're looking at different definitions, some new definitions of what it means to be poor in this country. As we're hearing, the U.S. Census Bureau recently came up with two figures,
And yet another study defined poverty as having scant resources in the event of a crisis. Today, we're looking at these poverty definitions and their significance for social policy. Our number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. How do you define poverty? What factors do you think should be included and which should not? Again, our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. And Robert Rector, I know you want to jump in. Go ahead, please.
Well, I think that the issue here is that for 40 years, and I've worked on this for 40 years just about, we could have done things like count food stamps as income. But essentially the left wing of the political spectrum said, no, we're not going to agree to do that, even though that's reasonable, unless we get a change and so that the poverty thresholds automatically go up when the middle income goes up. And that's what the Obama administration has unilaterally imposed on this system. And so the reality is, although you can talk all this thing about we count daycare, we don't, that's really not the fundamental change here. The fundamental change here is that you now have a definition of poverty in which poverty can be reduced only if the bottom third of the population, if the income in the bottom third of the population is rising faster than everybody else. Again, let me repeat that. The only way that poverty can be reduced, according to this system, is if the bottom part of the population has an income rising faster than everybody else.
Because it's all this relational.
This is a measure of inequality. If you create greater equality, then you have less poverty. But if the equality remains the same and everybody's living standard rises equally or proportionally, then there's no reduction in poverty. This is exactly what the Johnson administration says. Well, if you want to measure that, then call that inequality, but it doesn't have anything to do with poverty. And what you're doing here is basically smuggling in a spread the wealth goal under the Trojan horse, under the false banner of measuring poverty, when in fact this has virtually nothing to do with poverty in the sense that ordinary people understand it. And I would go so far as to say that it is deliberately intended to be misunderstood. People will rally to the concept of poverty because poverty means to them substantial material deprivation. Every poll that you look at for people, yes, that's what they're thinking about when they hear poverty.
And Robert, I got to cut you off there.
That's not what this is measuring.
And we will definitely pick it up after a short break. Sorry to cut you off there. And we'll take your calls, too, at 1-800-892-6477.
Good morning, it's 9:19, and support for NHPR comes from UR members and from the New Hampshire Association for the Blind, presenting Going Blind, Going Forward, February 25th at Wentworth Douglas Hospital in Dover from 1 till 3 p.m., sightcenter.org. And the attorneys at Orrin Reno, Global Vision, New Hampshire Values Trusted Business Advisors for Entrepreneurs, Business Owners, and Nonprofit Corporations, orrin-reno.com. More on Pondering Poverty in America on The Exchange on NHPR and at 10 on The Diane Rehm Show, efforts to stop Iran from developing a nuclear weapon. New Hampshire weather today, mix of clouds and sunshine, breezy and mild, highs from 36 to 40 in the North Country, mid-40s in central parts of the state and around 50 in southern New Hampshire. Then tonight, partly cloudy statewide, chance of flurries for the White Mountains, lows tonight from 20 to 25 across the state. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the struggle to define poverty and why a definition is important. We invite you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. How do you define poverty? What do you think should be included? What should not? How should these definitions be used politically and in terms of determining who gets public assistance? Do you think our definition of poverty needs to be expanded? If so, how so? Again, you can call 1-800-892-6477 or send a short email to exchange@nhpr.org. Also, The Exchange is now on Facebook. We hope you'll go to our page, join the conversation there. Our guests are Robert Rector, Senior Research Fellow at the Heritage Foundation, and Beth Mattingly, Director of Research on Vulnerable Families at UNH's Carsey Institute. And both of you, before we go to the phones, just a couple more things to clarify. So, Robert, before the break, you were talking about, again, your problem with this relational definition of poverty. You're saying we should define poverty by what you have, how well you're able to survive, not on how the family down the street
is doing. Yeah. So go ahead and finish that up, please.
The reality is that it's very clear when you look at polling data that the average American, when they're hearing the word poverty, what they're thinking about is material deprivation, not having enough food to eat, not having a decent apartment to live in, and so forth. And the reality is that even if you look at the old definition, the traditional definition of poverty, the overwhelming majority of people that the government defines as poor do not have material deprivations. When you see a newscast on poverty on TV, they'll generally feature a homeless family. Well, in the course of a year, only about 3% of the poor become homeless. In fact, 90% of poor Americans live in perfectly good houses or apartments, and on average, those houses and apartments of poor Americans happen to be larger than the average house of a non-poor person in France or in England. We talk about hunger, but in fact, 96% of poor parents, according to the USDA, report even in the middle of the recession, their children were not hungry for even a single day. When you look at the poor, 80% of them have air conditioning. Two-thirds of them have cable or satellite TV. Half of them have a computer in the home. 40% of them have internet. 25% of them have a TiVo. Okay, so their living standards, there's just this huge gap between the way poor people actually live and what the average person is thinking about when they hear poverty. And when you actually describe how poor people actually live, 80%, according to polling data, 80% of the public do not regard these individuals as being poor once you describe them. Now, the new system that the Obama administration is putting in would just make this gap much larger, so that there will be no connection whatsoever between poverty as people ordinarily think about it and what the government is defining as poor.
Beth, can you jump in here with your thoughts again, and then we'll go to our callers.
Sure. I want to respond to that and suggest that there is a lot of variability among the poor, and having material possessions does not necessarily mean that you have money for the necessities of life. And especially in the context of this recession, we're seeing a lot of people who've recently fallen into poverty who may have had those possessions from a previous middle-class lifestyle where they've lost their jobs and can't find new ones. And those aren't particularly liquid assets. They're not going to bring in a lot of cash to sustain the family. But I also want to caution against judging the poor based on what they may have in their homes. Everyone makes decisions about what to spend their money on. And for example, air conditioning was one of the examples. A poor family who has a child with asthma may need an air conditioner to alleviate those symptoms. Additionally, the air conditioner may be in an apartment that they rent, that it's not in their possession. And finally, just having that doesn't tell us about the quality or the age of that unit.
All right. Well, lots to talk about. Let's take our callers to, again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, today on The Exchange, we're digging into how we define poverty in America, given several new definitions of what it means to be poor in this country. And let's hear from you. How do you define poverty? What should be included and what should not? How should these definitions be used in terms of who gets public assistance, such as welfare or food stamps or free or reduced school lunch? Our number 1-800-892-6477. And let's go first, all of you, to Pat in Durham. Hi, Pat, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I lived around the world. When I first got married and was in the military with my wife, we had a place to live. We had two cars. One was older. One was brand new. TV, radio, never had to decide whether we were going to eat. And we found out that we were under the definition of being impoverished, which really sort of blew our minds. And we're approached about applying for assistance, which we did not. I'm on board with this Heritage Foundation idea that you know, we really need to look at how we define poverty. And I've lived in third world nations, and I've seen what poverty is, and we've got it in the United States, but not in the numbers that we report.
So,
I think we really ought to take a look at that and see. I don't think that we should judge it on what people own, because like the last speaker said, you know, that there's a lot of variables there. However, I think we're really too generous with what we call poverty.
So the income level overall is too high, you think?
Absolutely.
Right. Pat, thanks for calling in. Do you want to jump in there, Beth?
I do. I think one of the things we have to think about, poverty around the world varies greatly, and the poor in America are generally better off than the poor in some of the developing world. However, in a country as prosperous as the United States, we need to ask ourselves as a nation what level of hardship we're comfortable with for our neediest citizens, and to think about what we as a nation need to succeed and to be economically flourishing. If there's a way to bring these people into better jobs where they can be more productive members of society, we'll benefit from that productivity, but we'll also benefit because as a nation down the road, we'll pay less on things like health care and criminal justice responses. A recent report estimates that 4% of GDP goes to things like lost productivity, health care, and criminal justice because of poverty.
Well, and our caller brought it up, and you've brought it up too, Robert. So I do want to ask you, you know, both he and you talked about comparing the plight of poor people in America versus the rest of the world. But if we're not supposed to, in your opinion, compare poor people to middle-class people in America, is it valid to compare poor people in this country to poor folks in other countries?
I think what you want to do, well, that there's no comparison there. The poor are upper middle class by any standard globally, except perhaps in Europe. And in many respects, they're actually better than the average European, at least in certain parts of their lives. I think the more important thing is to compare what we mean by poverty to what the average citizen is thinking about when they listen to a program like this. And again, I've looked at virtually every TV newscast on poverty that has ever come out, at least in the last 10 years, and invariably when we have a report about poverty, what they show is a homeless family with a couple kids sleeping in the back of a van. And again, I have great sympathy for that family, and I'm very concerned about their well-being, but they, you know, that's 2 or 3% of the poor. Again, this is not just having air conditioning. It's not just having a TiVo. It's not just having internet access. Again, 90%, 50% of poor people have their own standalone house. Another 40% have an apartment. Only 10% of them are in a mobile home, for example. But even when you look at all these houses are larger than the average house in England. And they're in good repair. And then and then you go through. They have air conditioning. They have cable TV. They have internet access. Then, okay, now maybe they have those things and they don't have enough food to eat. But if you ask them, which the USDA does, did you have enough food to eat at all times during the previous year, 80% of so-called poor people will say, yes, we did. It's even stronger among children because the parents will make sure that the children have enough food to eat. 96% say, yes, we had enough food to eat. We might have wanted to have more expensive food, but we had enough food to eat. If you ask them, were you able to obtain medical care at any point you needed it in the year? And the government asks all these things. 85% of them will say, yes, we were. We actually go as a government out and we measure nutriments in the blood. We take blood samples over at HHS, and if you try to look and see what's the difference in terms of the nutrient quality of the poor and non-poor, you can't really find any difference. If I were to show you the average consumption of proteins, vitamins, and minerals among poor children and compare it to upper middle class children, there is no difference whatsoever. And as a consequence of that, the average poor child in the United States, when they grow up and hit age 18 or so, they happen to be 1 inch taller and about 10 pounds heavier than teenagers growing up back in the 1950s, when I grew up back in the time of Elvis. You don't do that if you're facing substantial, significant lack of food. This is a very, very well-nourished population that has most modern amenities and lives in very good housing. Now, I would like them to have higher standard of living, but we just need to be honest about what it is we're talking about here.
Well, what do you think, Beth? You know, Robert saying, hey, you know, there are people who are destitute and homeless and so forth, but that isn't the majority of the folks who we define officially as poor.
There are 2 points I want to make. First of all, Robert's 3% figure or whatnot about the homeless is one number. But the official poverty measure suggests that almost 7% of Americans are below half the poverty line in what's considered deep poverty. So the number of Americans who are really struggling is much higher than that 3% of poor people. I also want to point out that the reasons why many poor children are not hungry. And that is because of a lot of the nutrition assistance programs available to them. Many poor children qualify and get breakfast and lunch at school. Their families often get supplemental nutrition assistance or food stamps. And young families often get WIC. I also want to point out that about 10% more, about 14% of their parents are reporting having gone without enough food at some point during the year. So we see some parents likely going without so that their children can eat. And finally, I want to speak to the nutritional quality, because I think we're having a nationwide crisis with obesity here. And when we think about the types of food that poor children have access to, they're high-calorie processed foods. They're almost getting more of some things, but they're not getting the nutrition and the nutrients that they need from fresh fruits and vegetables and so forth. Really healthy food is time-consuming, and it's expensive. And the poor lack not only money, but also time.
Well, let's take some more calls, both of you. And our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And Beth and Robert, let's go next to Concord. Ed is calling in from Concord. Welcome, Ed. You're on the exchange. Go ahead.
Yes, good morning. Earlier, Beth made the comment and suggested that the reason to find out how many families are in poverty and to be able to define this, it was suggested that that will then help find a way to get jobs for these people, and I don't understand the connection at all. I don't believe it's connected, and I would just like some clarification on that, and I'll take that offline.
Okay, Ed, thanks a lot for joining us.
I didn't mean to say that knowing how many will help us get jobs for them. I was saying that getting jobs for poor America is in the nation's best interest.
But does having a definition of how big this population is help us in any way address these issues of employment and so forth?
Somewhat. I think what we see in among the poor, among poor families, we see more than two-thirds have at least one parent working. And so knowing that people are working and still living in poverty tells us something about the nature of work in America and really indicates the type of support that poor people are going to need in terms of childcare, in terms of wage subsidization, maybe through the earned income tax credit and other programs.
So that has to do with the new definition we talked about, Beth. It takes in a fuller picture of what people are spending in terms of child care and so forth, and as well as other sources of income like food stamps and so forth.
I wasn't really talking about how we measure it. I was talking about the importance
right.
of those programs.
But it does relate to this new
it
definition.
It does relate. The new definition includes the earned income tax credit, whereas the old definition is based upon pre-tax earnings. The thing about the new definition, Robert's talked about the relative nature of it, and part of it is relative, and I've talked about the income changes. It's a much messier definition. There are a lot more things that go into it.
Is that a good thing?
It provides a more nuanced portrait. It's harder to understand and harder to collect data. So I think going forward, we'll refine it in ways that make it more accessible.
But it's not going to be used for giving out programs and so forth, as you
said
in the beginning. Right now, we're still with the old one.
It can't be used to determine eligibility because it includes the program value. So at some point, programs are going to have to have some measure that says, okay, in order to receive this program, this is the cutoff. And if they include that program in the cutoff, it gets really messy and complicated.
I see. That is really tricky. And Robert, real quick to you, and then back to our callers.
Well, I think this definition is just much worse than the old one, and the old one wasn't very good. I think that we can really learn the most about poverty in the United States simply by having a factual discussion about how poor people live. Under this new standard, for example, you can be poor in San Francisco with an income of $40,000 a year with a family of four. It's just not a very realistic standard. And I think it will generate even additional confusion.
Although it is really expensive in San Francisco to live.
Well, not that expensive. And the reality is, if you want to start redistributing to people in San Francisco that make $35,000 a year, then you're not going to do other things. I think that misrepresenting how poor people live and creating a condition of alarm, and again, I'm not saying that poor people live the life of Riley. I would like them to have higher incomes, but I think we have to be honest about how they're living. Poor people do have to struggle to make ends meet, but typically a poor family is struggling to pay for a single-family dwelling, to pay for their car and keep it in repair, to pay their cable TV bill, their air conditioning bill, probably to pay for the computer that they have in the home, and to put food on the table. And that's very different than the image that you ordinarily get if you turn on the news and see a story about poor people, which usually has people in a soup kitchen or something like that. The overwhelming majority of poor people don't live that way. And again, we've heard some misrepresentation today. In fact, on average, poor children have exactly the same consumption of protein, mineral, and vitamins as do upper-middle-class kids. We don't get good policy based on bad information. What we do need to do is go back to Lyndon Johnson's original goal in the war on poverty, which was not to have more people on government assistance, but to make people prosperous and self-sufficient. And to do that, we need to look at the root causes about why they have lower incomes and begin to address that.
Getting to the jobs question partly that Ed asked. And Ed, thank you for that call. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. And from Portsmouth, Mark is on the air. Hi, Mark. Thanks for waiting. Go ahead.
Laura, I'm hearing a lot of theory, but I have a job that is, within the last 10 years, I've been in 15,000 homes across the United States. I have been in every project conceivable. I've been from Fort Kent, Maine, to San Juan, Puerto Rico, every state in the Union. And I couldn't agree with that gentleman anymore. I have yet to see poverty. Mind you, I have seen a lot of poor people, but they have all the basic necessities. I have dealt with the homeless. It is typically, I wouldn't say by choice, it's either mental illness, addiction, or by choice. They just don't, I'll tell them, you need to go to this program. No, I don't want to.
Mark, can I ask you a quick question because we're heading
sure.
into a break? You said, I've seen, what did you say? You said, I've seen poor people, but not poverty? Is that what you said?
That is correct.
So what's
the
difference?
The difference is that these people have all the basic necessities, every single one. And he is right. I've seen computers. I've seen large screen TVs. I have seen, I'll also say, I have seen people in very modest circumstances without any of those, but even those people have all the basic necessities. I have been in a house that was a home that was only 10 feet square. That gentleman had all the food he needed. He had electricity. He had sanitary. It was just this concept of poverty in this country. It doesn't exist. There are a raft of poor. Yeah, and the gentleman I saw in the 10-foot square house, he was happy.
So there's poor people, but not poverty. You're looking at it differently in that. And I think you're echoing some of the stuff that our guest Robert Rector said. And Mark, thank you for calling. We'll take more calls after a short break and follow up on some of Mark's points as well. Our number, 1-800-892-6477.
By now, you know you can donate your old car to NHPR. And you know how easy we make it by filling out the paperwork for you, picking up the car, and auctioning it off. But what you may not realize is that we accept more than just cars. You can donate anything to our vehicle donation program, from a snowmobile to an RV to a boat. Find out more at NHPR.org or give us a call and get the process started at 1-877-393-NHPR.
Support for NHPR comes from UR members, and support also comes to us from North Branch Construction, building green for their clients and themselves. Project portfolio at the newly designed webpage, northbranch.net. And from Crotchet Mountain School in Greenfield, nurturing growth, learning, sharing, and the singular joy of achievement for students with special needs. Information at crotchetmountain.org. Good morning. It's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, former UNH professor and economist Ross Cattell talks about his new job as chancellor of the Granite States Community College System. Email us your questions for Chancellor Cattell before the program at exchange@nhbr.org and join us tomorrow morning live at 9. Today, new definitions of poverty give a more nuanced view of Americans' economic health. We're looking at some of these new definitions and the debates surrounding them. And let's hear from you, too, at 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. And Beth Mattingly, I'm going to throw that last call to you, please. Again, saying that, look, there's poverty and there's poor people. And our caller defined poor people as, yes, limited means, but they still have everything they need. He says he didn't see a lot of poverty in America.
I think that most
of that dire circumstances.
Sure. And a lot of the poverty in America isn't a deprivation of basic human needs. We're seeing that people aren't dying of starvation or dying of hypothermia and things like that. But the question is, in our society, what level of relative hardship is acceptable? And I also want to point out some of the reason the poor are doing as well as they are is because of safety net programs. I also want to speak to the point about the size of housing and how much we have, because the point has been made that the poor, you know, maybe live in larger homes than they necessarily need if they lived in Europe. That's not necessarily their choice. We're not hearing stories and seeing statistics that show the poor are overwhelmingly choosing to pay more for larger homes when smaller residences are available. And so there's a certain level of Americans living large and architects building larger homes. We also talk about the cars and poor people having cars. Often these are necessary, particularly in rural America, for getting to work. And to Robert Rector's point about how much they're paying to maintain them, the poor don't have a new, well-running, fuel-efficient vehicle. And the expense of maintaining a car means often that the poor pay more for their transportation than people with better cars do.
We've got lots of calls. Let's go right back to them. Bernie's waiting in Swansea. Hi, Bernie. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Good morning.
Morning.
I just want to comment on nutrition. I was a superintendent of schools for 30 years, and I can remember teachers having peanut butter and jelly in their classrooms because children came into class without any breakfast. This man doesn't live in the real world. I saw this over the years. I saw cooks in the kitchen giving money so children could eat. I had one experience that we had a family that wasn't coming to school. So I went to that home, and I took the guidance counselor with me. And I saw the condition that they were living in. And when I left, the guidance counselor said something I'll never forget. He said, "This woman doesn't worry about sending her children to school tomorrow. She worries about feeding them tonight."
You know, what do you think, given your experience, Bernie, the official poverty level is 15%. We've heard Robert Rector and a couple other callers say, yes, there are desperately poor people, but it's a lot less than what those official numbers would say. What do you think?
I don't think they know the New Hampshire person. Most people that I dealt with in New Hampshire that were poor or didn't have the resources were so proud that we sometimes had to almost force them to take aid. New Hampshire, because of itself, people are very reluctant to say, "I'm poor, I can't afford to feed my children." They do all sorts of other things. And you can't live in a school environment. Go into a school and just talk to some primary teachers.
All right.
This happens.
Bernie, thanks a lot for calling. And that's the other side of it, Robert Rector, people who are too proud to take public assistance.
Well, except that about a third of the population of New Hampshire now takes one of those government programs. So I don't think that's very accurate. I don't think that you would find it very accurate that you have children who are hungry and their parents are refusing to take government aid. If that were true, you wouldn't have 50 million people on the food stamp program. The reality is that every year, the government itself goes out and very accurately tries to define these things and measure these things. It asks a question, for example, did your child miss even a single meal at any point last year because you didn't have enough money for food? And the answer to that is yes, there are some kids like that, but it's only about one child in 200 in the entire United States. And that data shows up again and again every time the government tries to investigate these things in detail. So are there kids that show up without having breakfast? Yes, about 1 in 10 poor children won't have breakfast. But when you look at the data behind that, it's often not because there's no food in the home, but because the family is fairly disorganized and isn't getting that breakfast done before the child leaves the house. I have a problem with that with my own teenager. And I don't want to make light of it. But the reality is that when you look at these things in detail, and the government does measure these things very carefully every single year, what you find is the overwhelming majority of people that we identify as poor do not face any type of food shortage whatsoever, and in particular, their children don't. There are some children that do, but it's a very small number. And we ought to be honest about that and understand that in order to devise better policies, because if our policies are devised to deal with an issue that really isn't there or is being grossly exaggerated, then we're not going to have policies that deal
with the real issues. The real issue, again, I think here, you know, and I would agree with what your caller said, that part of this is indeed because we're spending over $900 billion a year assisting poor and low-income people. That's close to $9,000 for each lower-income American. You can't spend that kind of money and still have tens of millions of people that don't have food to eat. These programs do support boost living standards, but critically, they don't help the poor join mainstream society, and they don't help the poor to become self-sufficient. In fact, I would argue they kind of push very strongly in the other direction by undermining those conditions that lead to middle-class prosperity.
Beth, do you want to jump in and then some more callers?
I do. I want to reiterate my points. And as Robert just said, the safety net does help people so that the poor aren't hungry. And without the safety net, many more would experience hunger. And I also want to point out, we don't know the nutrition quality. Just because they haven't skipped a meal doesn't tell us what they ate.
We do know the nutrition quality, and I've already said it.
I would also like to point out this issue of raising people out of poverty. The safety net catches people. And so if someone is a middle-class person with a lot of social capital and loses their job and falls into poverty, the safety net may help them stay on their feet to a certain extent, and they may themselves be able to get out of poverty. What the safety net doesn't do is provide, in Newt Gingrich's terms, a trampoline for escaping generations of poverty, for escaping years and years of poverty. And that's where we really need to focus on doing a better job.
Let's take another call. This is Harley in Elliott, Maine. Go ahead, Harley. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, just a quick history. So I'm a former Marine. I've deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan. I dare somebody to challenge my experience dealing with poverty. And honestly, I haven't met a single person in the United States who's definitively poor. I know a gentleman who's been recently laid off. He went about 6 months without work, landed the first mortgage he could find on a house that was too big for his wife and his child to share with him. And lo and behold, he lost his job again. So now he's struggling to pay for this giant house. He's got like a 50-inch TV. You know, they've got like three vehicles. I mean, the cost of oil to heat his home alone, if he could just get a smaller home, he could afford to buy food.
So are you saying low-income people are making poor financial decisions, Harley?
I think that people are poor because they make decisions that make them poor, and some people are rich because they make the decisions that keep them wealthy. I don't think anybody was born with less of a chance to make wealth than anyone else. Then people make poor decisions, and then they just spiral down until they have nothing.
Wow, okay.
The guy bought a house he couldn't afford. I mean, you can buy a chicken at BJ's for $1.99 a pound. You know, I don't know how these people are going hungry. I don't need any hungry people.
Well, Holly, thanks for calling. Yeah, and thanks for calling, and thanks for your time as a service member as well. And boy, Robert Rector, Beth Mattingly, we could probably spend a whole week on this issue that Harley raises. So, Harley, thank you. You know, the idea that why people are poor. I don't think we can solve that question in this hour, Robert Rector, but I'd love your thoughts on what Harley raises.
Well, again, I think
poor financial decisions.
He's accurately describing what people think about poverty in the U.S. We ask a polling question of a nationally representative sample in which we described, according to government surveys, how the typical poor person lives, and then we ask whether that person was poor or not. And we said a family in the U.S. that has a decent, uncrowded house or apartment to live in, ample food to eat, access to medical care, a car, cable TV, and air conditioning should or should not be considered poor. And in response to that question, 80% of Republicans said, no, that individual is not poor. And 77% of Democrats said that individual is not poor. Well, and if you look at the research, that's in fact the typical person that the government defines as poor. There's just this huge gap between the government defining people as poor and what the poverty means to the average American citizen.
As one of our earlier callers said, he says he sees poor people but not poverty. What do you think, Beth? And then we'll go back to our callers.
I think the definition...
Poor people making bad financial decisions. That's what Harley's point was.
Right. I think that a lot of people have made bad financial decisions, and there are people who, because they don't have the same opportunities as everyone else, are more likely to fall into poverty as a result of one or two bad decisions, whereas people who've had more education, more affluence throughout their lives, who have more social networks, may weather the storm of a bad financial decision much better. I do want to speak, though, to this notion of what poverty is. And I think that we can all agree there are different levels of deprivation. But I think the rosier picture that Robert Rector just painted neglects to consider a lot of the hardships that aren't necessarily as tangible. We've done a lot of interview work with poor families, and I know a family who would meet that definition, but in my mind is definitely poor because of all the extra effort and all the extra work they're doing and how little they have to get by. So this mother chose not to go to the laundromat and spend money doing her laundry, but every night scrubbed the kids' clothes and her clothes in the sink to save money. And so she's up, she doesn't have time to do the things that might, the educational activities that may help lift her out of poverty. So it's a hassle and time as well as lack of money.
Well, thanks for that call again, Harley. And let's take one more. This is Tanya in Enfield. Hi, Tanya. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning. I just have a comment for what Robert has said about children that are in poverty having equal nutritional value foods than people that are not in poverty. And I've had my struggles financially, but thankfully now I'm doing much better. There was a time when I did have to depend on government services and the food that you get, you know, canned peaches versus a fresh peach are completely different. And I could see why people that are poor have more health problems because the food that they're eating are not of high quality nutrition. So I think that there is a huge difference between the quality of food that the people that have money that could choose what they like versus getting whatever's in the shelters.
Okay.
You know, you can't really, you can't go and buy fresh fruit. It's all canned.
With high fructose corn syrup. Thanks a lot for calling in, Tanya. What do you think, Robert? You do see more obesity among poor families. Does that mean that Tanya's right in terms of the poor quality of food?
Actually, you used to. That seems to be diminishing, and obesity is now kind of an equal opportunity character. The reality is, again, we just saw that characterization. The simple fact is that most poor people never go anywhere near a free food pantry during the course of a year because they don't need to. And again, the USDA, since the 1930s, has gone out and measured what people actually eat, and then it looks at the nutriment quality of that. And when you look at that, particularly among poor children, there is no difference whatsoever in the consumption of vitamin A, vitamin B, vitamin C, on average, between poor and upper-middle-class kids. That's just simply a fact. The government also goes out and takes a blood sample. Okay, and it says we're looking for vitamins in the blood. We're looking for protein in the blood. And you know what? How much protein deficiency you find in the U.S. because they don't have enough, poor people don't have enough food to eat? Zero. Okay, so the reality is that we have this picture of dire conditions, people going into soup kitchens and stuff to eat, and those people are there, but they are a tiny fraction of the people that we're identifying as poor. And we need to focus on them. We need to be to care for them. We need to be concerned about them. But we also need to be honest that we don't need these extreme figures of saying that there are 30 or 40 million people in the United States that are living like that. Because I can tell you quite simply, if you look at the government data, a poor child is much more likely to have an HD TV in his home than he is to have missed a meal in the last 6 months, according to the government's own data.
And Tanya,
this huge gap between poverty the way that it's ordinarily discussed and what the government defines as poor.
And Tanya, thanks a lot. And to Tilton and Lynn, and go ahead, Lynn, you're on the air.
Hi, yes. I was a public health nurse in Arlington, Virginia. And one of the things that I noticed, my husband was in the service, and we were living in this tiny apartment, and there was somebody that we were serving that was in a six-room, beautiful colonial on one of the Arlington parks. She was a single mother with kids. But basically, she really wasn't a single mother because she had a basic husband who was a carpenter who made good money. And
right.
So she's counted as poor, but, you know, they made more money than we did, and we didn't get any assistance. And then there's somebody else that we saw, and we were helping, they were going to have a baby. And so they get money to get stuff for the baby, and they buy a double bedroom set. And then another teenager gets pregnant in her junior year, and the guidance counselor works with she and the father to set them up playing house in an apartment.
Lynn, are you saying that... quick question in the interest of time. Are you saying in the instance where the husband was a carpenter that a lot of this income was not counted, so they were better off?
Well, yeah. It wasn't counted at all, no.
Okay.
Right.
And, you know, I don't think anybody minds helping somebody that really needs it and really is trying to get to make something better for themselves. But I think that one of the points is that it's just too many people that are just trying to take things. And that's the part that I think that people really object to, people that are feeling that they're owed and we need to give it to them.
Okay, and Lynn, I'm going to wrap you up in the interest of time. Beth, go ahead.
I can't dispute that there are some people who may take advantage of the system, who may be trying to get more than they should.
Or uncounted income, cash under the table. There's a lot
of
that.
Sure, there's a lot. But my experience suggests very strongly that that's not the majority of the poor, that the majority of poor are hardworking, are doing their best, and really want to better themselves and be in a situation where they don't need to rely on others.
All right. Well, Beth, thank you very much for being here. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And Robert Rector, thank you also for your time.
Thank you.
Robert Rector is a senior research fellow at the Heritage Foundation. Beth Mattingly, director of research on vulnerable families at UNH's Carsey Institute. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. The Exchange is now on Facebook. Join our page to continue this conversation and learn more about what we're doing every day. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy.